This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Letters from Kayfabe. And, well, we've made it to 10 episodes, Alan. How does that make you feel?
Oh, it makes me feel good. Double figures we've got there. Normally with my projects, I never reach double figures with any kind of podcasts I've done in the past. So you've done well to keep me up to 10, Parv.
Well, you know, many podcasts never make it this far. So we're happy, and we're happy from all the support that we've had as well. Every week, lots of people are telling us that they're listening, and that helps keep us going, doesn't it, Alan?
Oh yeah, definitely. We've had lots of love online, be it on Twitter, be it on Pro Wrestling Only, Facebook and elsewhere. So thank you very much for chiming in, guys, telling us you support the show. And if you want to, best thing you can do to support us is to find the iTunes feed for Pro Wrestling Only and give us a 5-star review on there, because we'd really appreciate that.
Great. Well, without further ado, Alan, let's go to the mailbag.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Right, let's see what we've got in the sack this week then, Parv. So, the first question this week is, Dear Alan and Parv, Battle Cat, great gimmick or greatest gimmick? And that's from Erin Quinn on Twitter, who's from Austin in Texas. So, Erin, a bit of a fan of Battle Cat, the gimmick. What's your take on that one, Parv?
Well, I mean, the mask is quite nice. That was my first. I went back and watched everything that I could find of the Battle Cat, and I was very impressed with the quality of the fur on the mask. I have to say, in his debut match, he looked pretty impressive as an actual wrestler. He pulled out like a snap suplex there, and in a long line of cat wrestlers, you know, Tiger Mask. Who else would be there? Didn't Marty Jones work a few matches? No, Rollerball Rocco worked as...
Oh, he was Black Tiger, yes. Yeah, there's many incarnations of Black Tiger over the years. I think we're up to number 8 now, and there's one that's reappeared in All Japan this week, funnily enough. But yeah, there's cat gimmicks all over wrestling. You've got the big cat Ernie Ladd. you've got Mr. Hughes, who played some sort of cat.
Big cat.
A big cat, there you go. So there's quite a few cats, but this guy, there's a Battle Cat. He was originally, there's two Battle Cats, if people didn't know that. And the first one, the most famous one, was Brady Boone, was under the hood. And Boone was someone who actually attended Robbinsdale High School, which some people might recognize. It's in Minnesota. And that's where Kurt Hennig and other guys like Rick Rude came from. And yeah, he worked the gimmick. This would have been 1990 October time he debuted. And it was quite interesting. He debuted on Wrestling Challenge before appearing on Superstars, which is quite interesting. Normally it was the other way around. You debut on Superstars and then Wrestling Challenge, which was the syndicated B show, will be the next thing. But yeah, he debuted, and his first match that made TV was against Bob Bradley, wasn't it, Parv?
Yes, and I watched this earlier on. Bob Bradley, of course, you know, reasonably well-known, long-time jobber to the stars. And I was actually pretty impressed with the Battle Cat's prowess in the ring, Alan. You know, snap suplex and a beauty, good agility. His backflips look good. I think there was good potential in this gimmick, to be honest. It could have, like, in an alternate universe, you know, like a universe where the Undertaker gets over, for example. It could have been good. So I mean, there's nothing really stopping it taking off. I didn't think it was that lame at all.
No, it was all right. It was one of those gimmicks that could fit something that appealed to children, really. I think it was you know, mainly aimed at. I think that was the mindset from the off. But I liked he had a paw on his ass. And in later incarnations, in his second or third matches, he had paws under his actual boots. So, you know, the bottom of his boots, you could see paws on there. And what he would do as well, he'd kind of paw to the audience like a cat and stroke his ears. But the best thing that I enjoyed about him, I think it was his second match that I watched, he had this cape Parv. I don't know if you noticed it, this purple cape, but it was a cape that didn't have anything that could tie around him. So he had to kind of hold this cape as he ran to the ring. It made it quite awkward looking, this big purple cape. But his finishing manoeuvre on the first match was the cat's cradle, which was a victory roll. And then after that, he transitioned into a Luthes press. I don't know kind of what he called that move, but that's what happened with him. But it wasn't his first time he'd been in the WWF, interestingly enough, Parv. Before this, he had a cup of coffee in the WWF in 87-88 time. He was the cousin of Billy Jack Hayes, due to the similar appearance and build, which, you know, if you look at Brady Boone underneath, you know, pictures online of him, he does have the beard, he does have the hair. You could see a resemblance between him and Hayes.
It's, to be fair to him, it seems more than a cup of coffee. I mean, he was there from what I can see, from July of 87 all the way until September of 88 as Brady Boone. I mean, he's mainly working in fact what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, he's at the same sort of level as Steve Lombardi, as Barry Horowitz. You know, these are the sorts of guys he would be trading wins and losses with on that strata of the card. But he was a house show regular during that period. I mean, that's over a year. So,
well, fair enough. Maybe more than a cup of coffee. Maybe one of those big jugs of coffee you can get from the takeaway, maybe in the mornings instead. But he was also around elsewhere. He was in Pacific Championship Wrestling, based out of Oregon. So I think that might have been why he had a link with Billy Jack, or why Billy Jack may have brought him into the WWF. You don't know. And also an interesting fact about him, Rob Van Dam's been on record, and he named Brady Boone as his main inspiration for breaking into the business. And it was Boone that got RVD into All Japan around 96, I would say. So thanks to Brady Boone, that's why we've got Rob Van Dam around.
Yeah, and judging by that one match against Bob Bradley, I would suggest that old Brady Boone was probably a better worker than Rob Van Dam.
Yeah, he showed some flashes there, and he went elsewhere as well later on. He was in WCW in 93-94. There's actually a match where he plays Firecat versus Steve Austin in 94 in a losing effort. And he was also around in Herb Abrams' UWF, which that sort of wacky gimmick would fit Herb Abrams down to
the T. Seems to be the destination for a lot of the wrestlers that we cover on this show, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a payday for them. With that incarnation then, he beat Bob Bradley with a victory roll, which was his debut. He also worked with Coco Beware versus the Orient Express, which is online as well if people want to check that out.
It's a high-flying team.
Yeah. What would you class that team as there? So what Coco Beware in 1990, because we like to touch on this, don't we, Parv? Him working, he's not really classed as a job a Battle Cat because he's winning, isn't he? So are they just a low-tier team?
I just think this is low-tier. I mean, the Orient Express are around there as well, aren't they? Just kind of challenge level star. I mean, they're stars. They're not jobbers. They're stars. Challenge is about the right level for these guys.
Well, fair enough. I think challenge level, I agree with that. But after Brady Boone, I don't know why he left doing the Battle Cat gimmick, but after that, Bob Bradley was under the hood, and he was athletic to a point, but not as much as Brady Boone, was he?
Well, that's a little bit of an understatement. I happened to watch a match of his as Battle Cat taking on the one and only Boris Zukov, Alan. Hilarious 8 minutes of my life as Sean Mooney and Lord Alfred Hayes do nothing but cat puns for the entire 8 minutes, and it's of the quality of like the cat has got his cream.
You know what? I've not seen this. I'm gonna have to watch this.
It's hilarious.
That's the stuff I love with those two on commentary.
Mooney is just relentless with the cat puns on there. It's like every single move is like, ooh, that was perfect, and is really on that kind of level. But I have to say, the difference between Boone and Bradley as Battle Cat is night and day, Alan. I mean, yes, he does a few backflips and things, but my God, awful. The Thez press that he does to end that match is just hideous. So there we go.
So yeah, in a world of roosters, snakes, dragons and bulldogs, they needed a cat, really, didn't they, at the time? So I think this was a Vince gimmick, if I've ever seen one. So is there anything else you want to add about the Battle Cat gimmick and the two guys that played him?
No, I think we've hit on it enough. One thing I will say is that everybody should check out that Boris Zukov Battle Cat match, mainly for the Mooney and Lord Al commentary. At one point, I even Facebooked this to you, Alan. Lord Al says he's deadly like a rhinoceros, not a hippopotamus. That he was saying that of Boris Zukov after Mooney said he's not the fastest, not the fastest wrestler that there is. So that's a classic level of match where I love the commentary.
Wow, well, definitely watching that, the cat would have got my tongue watching that.
let's move on.
Right, so the next question in the old sack this week is, Dear Alan and Parv, did Fantasio disappear as a result of one of his magic tricks going badly wrong? And that was from Carl on Twitter in England. So Carl, big supporter of the show and pro wrestling only shows in general. Is this his first appearance of Carl? Because we've had a Carl Harris. Is this the same guy?
Yeah, we had a Keith before. Let's say this is the debut of Carl.
Okay, welcome, Carl. Is it Fantasio? Is how we pronounce his name in WWF?
Fantasio, yeah.
Well, he's Harry Del Rios. He's a bodybuilder from New York. He was a bodybuilder from New York. He was trained by Johnny Rods. And his first break came in the USWA in 1993, where he played the Spellbinder. Have you ever heard of him before you kind of covered this for the show?
To be honest, Alan, no. Not really one on my radar, the Spellbinder. I haven't really explored USWA in that period.
Well, it was someone that I watched his only match in 95, and I do remember it at the time because it was something different. I don't think the crowd knew what to make of it, but the match itself, he worked, it was Tony DeVito, who people might remember him from ECW as a member of the Baldies team. Yeah. So, Fantasio, what did you make of him yourself, Parv, in ring?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll note on the match is that the commentary team here is Jim Ross and Gorilla Monsoon, and Gorilla goes straight in there with not Danny DeVito as one of his opening gambits when they talk about Tony DeVito.
Yeah, and they said he looks a bit more like Rhea Perlman as well, which I thought was a bit of an insult to Danny DeVito's wife there. But yeah, I thought Gorilla Monsoon, he practically shit his pants with amazement at the tricks that he was seeing in front of him. So he came down to the ring, Fantasio, and he changed something into... He had a little stick and he made it bigger, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like into a long stick. And that was the first time that, Gorilla, basically lost his mind. And I thought to myself, has he never been to a five-year-old's birthday party? And the wonder and magic continues throughout the match. So as Fantasio removes his top hat and his command smoke shoots out of it into the air. And if Monsoon hadn't shit his pants by now, he definitely did then. So it was all over this. But I thought Fantasio himself, he was a decent looking guy. He was 6'4", 6'5", maybe, 250, 260. He looked the part. But he was pretty gross because he, if you watch the actual uncut version of the match, he ends up pulling a ribbon out of his mouth, like one of those really hokey tricks a clown does.
Yeah.
And then what he does, he proceeds to then give that to a child at ringside.
Well,
so he's trying to copy Bret Hart there, but I don't know if it's as effective.
Well, one of the highlights of the segment was him essentially, as we would say in this country, kegging Tony DeVito. He basically steals his underpants, doesn't he?
Well, he basically does. He steals Tony DeVito's underpants. This is probably one of the worst, stupidest finishes you'll ever see in a wrestling match. So what he does, he kind of rolls Tony DeVito up, but just before that, he pulls his underwear up from outside of his tights, which he's got little hearts on them, and that distracts Tony DeVito enough, for Fantasio to get the pin, which, was an interesting way. And then after that, poor Earl Hebner gets involved, doesn't he?
Yeah. And the kind of punchline is that Earl Hebner's pants have the ref stripes on them, so that's what his boxer shorts.
That was the little joke there, wasn't it? But the one thing that I thought was ludicrous in the match as well is, he does this thing where he throws a web, it looks like Spider-Man web out of nowhere on DeVito. DeVito basically like Gorilla Monsoon earlier, shits himself, and, you know, get powders out the ring, goes out the ring, all for some paper streamers. So, you know, how believable is that when, you know, a guy, you know, is a wrestler, gets scared of paper streamers. It wasn't even one of those snakes in a can. You know, you can kind of understand that, because that could shock you. But it's some damn paper streamers, so DeVito, man up.
What I'll say is, though, just like Battle Cat, you know, in a world where The Undertaker has a 20-year career, like, in an alternate universe, I could see this getting over. I mean, he looked cool. Like, the makeup is pretty good, I would say, compared to, you know, he looks like that had potential. Like, I don't know, that, what was that thing? V for Vendetta? That got over big time.
Well, so, well, it was like, it looks like a kind of weird Crow version of Sting a little bit. If, you know, Crow Sting was a sad magician at a children's birthday party, you know. But no, it was all right. But the interesting thing that Del Rios actually says and comes out with, he did an interview with Figure Four Online in 2010, and he believes the character was squashed because the Undertaker thought it was too closely resembling his character. Which, you know, I don't know how many times you've seen The Undertaker come to the ring dressed as a mime and pull endless ribbons out of his mouth. But, you know, that's what he puts down to it. But the interesting thing as well in this interview with F4W Online was he said he was the first guy ever to get a WWF developmental deal, technically. So he was already in Memphis. WWF liked him. They signed him, but they sent him down to Memphis, you know, in 93 and 94. So he kind of perfected the gimmick, because he was interested in, he took the actual gimmick to the WWF, but it was a gimmick you'd probably think Vince McMahon would go for in a heartbeat, wouldn't you? A magician. You know, that's my Vince McMahon impression, but, you know, that's a gimmick that Vince would have loved. So he kind of honed his craft in Memphis for a few years, and then he did work the WWF more than just that one match. He was in a lot of dark matches. Hey, if you looked at his career,
not only did The Undertaker squash the gimmick, he also stole all the ideas and used it in 1999 for that bloody corporate ministry bollocks they did. Do you remember all of that?
What did he do then? Did he throw some paper out of his mouth?
There was a lot of magic involved in that whole angle, I seem to recall. You know, Stephanie on the burning cross and all that stuff. Did you not remember that angle?
Oh, no, I remember that. I think, you know, that was a bit more the craft than the magician. But yeah, it was working up until 97 on house show matches around the Memphis area. So he was a guy that obviously, you know, lived in the Memphis area, and because he worked there, his career wasn't noteworthy at all, really, because he, after his USWA, he then was still around in Memphis when it transitioned to Power Pro and then Memphis Championship Wrestling. But he did have one match for TNA. And that was TNA's first pay-per-view gauntlet for the gold match, and he looked a bit like Scott Steiner.
I will say he didn't look awful in this one match. Like, you know, you watch some matches and you think this guy can't wrestle at all, and he wasn't that bad. I didn't think he wasn't offensive.
He had some little gimmicks as well. He had a little plastic mask he pulled off, and he gave that to someone at ringside as well, and underneath that was the face paint. So he did. He would, another character that could appeal to kids in a way.
Could have gotten over. Could have been a doink tag team partner, maybe. I don't know.
Well, maybe, but it was another one that could have, you know, you could have played him up his face or heel, depending as if Del Rios could kind of pull that off.
He could have been a lot more sinister. He could have played.
Yeah, that's
sinister,
what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So there was definitely more mileage for the character, but we'll put it down to The Undertaker for squashing that one. Well, according to Del Rios, anyway.
Mm. Okay, time for one more, I think.
Right, so the last question in this short form in the mailbag is, Dear Alan and Parv, what happened to Tom McGee? And that's from The Loaded Glove on Twitter, who's from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. So thank you, Mr. Loaded Glove.
I really like The Loaded Glove because he's got Ted DiBiase as his kind of avatar on Twitter. So
anyone that has that is over with you. So if you want to impress Parv, guys, you want to get DiBiase avatar, you'll be pleased. So Tom McGee is someone that's kind of quite a cult figure in certain circles, isn't he? As someone who has been spoken about a lot more than his actual amount of matches deserves, because he only had 31 matches in total in the WWF, I counted up. You know, for that, I mean, why do people ask a lot about him? Who is he, Parv?
Well, I mean, this is a weird thing, because he was actually around a lot more than he was on TV, if that makes any... Like, he was kind of like a pet project in a way that hung around way longer than you'd expect. So You can see that he had his first match against Bret Hart in 1986. And he's one of these guys who he's stacked. He's well built. He was talked up at different times as possibly being the next Hulk Hogan. although maybe, you know, more realistically, he could have been like the next, I don't know, Kerry Von Erich or Ultimate Warrior or something like that. Because he's closer to that in terms of his look, I would say.
Yeah, he wasn't as like his body shape was more like that. He was actually a powerlifter, and he once held the World's Strongest Man title. I don't know, that title is a gimmick more than anything, really. But yeah, he definitely looked the part, and someone who, you know, he was athletic as hell, to be fair to him. But just because someone's athletic doesn't necessarily mean that transitions into, you know, someone who can work well in the ring. And he was someone that was completely, you know, couldn't work at all, could he, Parv? I mean, have you seen any of his matches?
Yeah, I've watched a fair few of his matches here and there, and I also just watched a few just for this, including the now legendary, for some reason, Arn Anderson match from 1988. Because I remember when that surfaced, like my, you know, sometimes your private messages light up, and weirdly, that was a day where loads of people thought, I have to see this match. And it was because he gets a count out victory against Arn there in 88. But basically, there's a few matches out there on YouTube if you just search. He's mostly buried in house shows uploaded by Richard Land. But there's one match out there against Terry Gibbs that I watched earlier on
what
today.
What a treat. What a treat, Parv.
Now, did you watch this match?
No, I watched it years ago. I mean, I've seen everything I need to see with Tom McGee. He had a good backflip off the top rope for someone his size. But you watched this match, didn't you, Paul? What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, as per usual, my first comments are about the commentators, because on this one, it's Gorilla Monsoon and Honky Tonk Man. And my God, did they bury him on there.
What year was this then?
I'm trying to work this out now. This would have been at some point in 1987, I want to say.
And Honky's, I didn't know Honky did any commentary around that time.
Yeah, it was definitely around the time where, yeah, it has to be 87. And I was trying to actually figure out which one it was. Because if you actually look at his results, he wrestled Terry Gibbs around the horn.
Yeah, we did some in January of 87 and then some in April, May. Yeah. Oh, May, June, sorry.
And I couldn't figure out which one it was. I'm guessing this was on a prime time match. This was,
yeah, like, because all time. The kind of markets that they run the house shows in aren't, I don't know, markets that they would necessarily film stuff for a house show.
I couldn't really work out where this would have been, like the results.
Who won the match?
McGee won the match. Gibbs does get in quite a lot of offense. And Honky Tonk Man's on commentary just saying, this guy is just a muscle head. You guys talked him up as the next Hulk Hogan. He hasn't got a hope. And then even Monsoon gets in on it where he says, you know, Honky Tonk Man actually calls him green on commentary. He actually uses the term, he's still very green, isn't he? And Monsoon actually quotes someone. I don't remember who he quotes, but he basically says yes, he may be athletic, but, you know, it's what you know in this business that counts type thing. And this guy basically, like, has got a lot to learn. Even Monsoon goes as that. So, really, in a three-minute squash match, they don't really put him over at all. So you can kind of tell that the boys had it in for him. I mean, obviously, Honky Tonk Man's a bit of a heat seeker, but Monsoon was laying the boot in as well there, Alan. In terms of how good he was as a worker, absolutely hopeless. I mean, kind of Ted Arcidi levels, basically.
There was this touted match, though, against Bret Hart, which must have been his debut match.
From 86, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk online over the years that this match was the match that made Vince think that Tom McGee was going to be the next Hulk Hogan because of how well Bret carried him. I mean, he had the match with Arn that's made tape, and Arn, you know, I love Arn Anderson. You know, a lot of listeners may, you know, follow me on Twitter. I'm forever posting, you know, gifs of his spine busters and DDTs. So Arn Anderson drags him into an okay match, and I think that's the best match I've seen of Tom McGee. But he also, as well as working WWF, he had some tours with All Japan, and I'd be really interested to see one of the matches here, which was Akira Taue versus Tom McGee.
Oh, in
April 1988, Parv. So, you know, if I could track down that match and it was a better match than the Arn Anderson one, that would give more credibility to the claim that Tawei is a great worker who should be in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
I mean, I'm seeing some of his other matches. He had a match with Ujima. Can you imagine how awful that was?
Yeah, that was the final match on the... I think that was the final match on the tour.
I mean, Ujima is another completely hopeless case of a guy who got over in another sport or in another field, and they thought that they could just drag him into wrestling and it would work, and it didn't. So there we go. Yes, I honestly...
Well, with the Ujima matches, they only went short.
I honestly think that he's one of the worst people that we've... talked about in terms, I mean, yes, he did have athletic ability, but he's one of those guys who just got like no sense of timing, or everything he does doesn't look quite right, you know. And I actually don't think he's got a very good look. He's got a bit like a buck tooth as well, so yeah.
You could stick him under a hood.
I actually couldn't see a world where Tom McGee would get over, but I can see a world where Battle Cat and Fantasio could get over. So there we go.
There was a funny story I saw about McGee online. He was in a match in Vancouver against Butch the Jackal Moffat. And Moffat held him down in the middle of the ring in a leg scissors. And the person who told the story, he was sitting at the announcer's table and he could hear the two talking. And on the occasion, McGee would whisper quite loudly, "Don't squeeze too hard, I've got the runs." So Moffat, as the veteran that he is, looked at him for a moment, then hissed, "Cut loose, baby," as he tightened his grip, and McGee squirmed as hard as he could to get out. He wasn't working, he was desperate to get out, and the match went to a 20-minute draw apparently, and somehow Tom made it to the end without experiencing an embarrassing moment. And as the second the bell rang, he rolled out the ring, hightailed it up to the aisle as fast as he could, and then Moffat got on the mic and shouted, "Look at him go, he's scared of me."
Well, there we go. And I can see that he endured even into 1989, Alan, where he exclusively faces Tim Horner around the horn.
Tim Horner, I mean, he does know there's the one match with Jim Powers as well.
Yeah, with Powers too, yeah, I can see.
Yeah, but yeah, the actual question from Mr. Glove was what actually happened to him, and I'm not 100% sure, apart from he just faded away with Tim Horner, and that's the last we heard of him. I could make an interesting backstory up if people wanted, but I'm not actually too sure. I don't know.
Hopefully he just woke up one day and realised that this wasn't the business for him and called it a day.
Yeah, well, like we will on the question. So thanks for the question anyway, Loaded Glove. So yeah, shall we now go to our friend JT?
Yes, let's go to JT Rosero for the event centre.
Let's take you down to the event centre.
Thank you, Parf. Thank you, Alan. JT Rosero here inside the Letters from Kayfabe Event Center. Hopefully everyone's enjoying this episode. We're here to go back to 1989 this week. Right around this time in the fall of 89, going back to Superstars on November 11th from Wheeling, West Virginia, taped on October 2nd. And we had quite the interesting debut as Dino Bravo and the Ultimate Warrior were undergoing a test of strength segment where Dino Bravo did push-ups with Jimmy Hart on his back. And then Hart selected the biggest man in the audience to come out, and Bravo could show that he would do push-ups with him instead. Oakland interviewed the man. His name was John from West Virginia, and he weighed 460 pounds. Bravo completed several push-ups with John on his back. So then the Ultimate Warrior came out, was about to complete the same task, but John hit a sit-down splash on the Warrior's back instead of sitting on him, and he and Bravo proceeded to attack the Warrior, and John hit some splashes. Warrior got back up and ran backstage looking for Bravo and John. Of course, the whole thing was a big setup, a big ruse. The next week, John would be introduced as the Canadian Earthquake and would be paired up with Dino Bravo and Jimmy Hart. Didn't really have much of a feud with Ultimate Warrior to start. He was just kind of hanging around with Bravo, but they would get heavily involved in the Ultimate Challenge that came in the build-up to WrestleMania 6 as they played a key role in both Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior's lives, involved in matches with the two of them. And, of course, would attack both guys, had a big win over Hercules at WrestleMania, and then would be off and running when he destroyed Hogan on the Brother Love Show in April of 90, setting off his biggest run, arguably, of his career. And, of course, John Tenta would go on to have quite the career. until losing his battle with cancer in the mid-2000s. Beloved guy, you never heard anything bad about him, sumo champion, and a great debut here in the fall of 89. They did a great job with it. They made him look like a monster immediately and an immediate threat to a guy like Ultimate Warrior, who had a fantastic look but fell prone to this evil plot from the men run by Jimmy Hart. So there we have it. We're going to head back over to Parv and Alan in a moment, but first I want to remind you to check out everything going on at PlaceToBeNation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world. We have all kinds of different feeds for you on iTunes, the Place to Be podcast feed, PWO, PTBN, PTBN Pop, and the Kevin Kelly Show. So check all those out. Follow us on social media. And, of course, visit the site each and every day. So back to Parv, back to Alan. I'm out. We'll talk to you next week. Everyone take care.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Rosero. Fascinating as ever. And you guys have made peace, Alan.
Yeah, no, we've made peace. Me and JT, best friends. I'm looking forward to exchanging gifts with him at Christmas. JT, don't scrimp on my present. Anything pro-graps related, I'll be very grateful of. So, yeah, exciting times ahead for JT and I's relationship going forward.
God, it's like the kiss my ass club here. one thing I couldn't help but notice during the mailbag. No Chadley this week, Alan. What happened?
I don't know, Chadley. He must have settled on the last show who his favourite wrestler was going to be. And I think, was it on the last show? Was it Big Bully Busick? It was the last show, wasn't it?
I think like maybe Busick,
yeah, he settled on Busick. So maybe he's searching for those Busick matches that we spoke about that were working for Ole Anderson's Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Well, why don't we go to the long question?
Right, the long question in the stack. Let me just get this now, reach in. It's Dear Alan and Parv, who were some of Hogan's allies in the WWF? And that's from a good friend of the show, and that's Mark Wren, who's from the great city of Slough in England.
Mark.
So good brother Mark Wren. So he wants to know some of Hogan's allies, and Hogan had a fair few of them over the years, didn't he, Parv?
He did. Shall we start at the very beginning, as we do with these long term questions? We're of course talking the WWF here, and right from the very get-go, Alan, his first buddy, do you know who it is?
It's one of my people that I've gone to appreciate in the last few years, and that's Bob Backlund.
Absolutely right. So Hogan turns up as the mystery partner for Backlund against the Samoans in a very interesting moment where they actually hype his return to the WWF, and Hogan actually announces that he's turned his back on his previous ways. So they do acknowledge the heel run when he comes back in. And it's also interesting that he basically comes in as Backlund's partner. So a lot of people think that it's just kind of, you know, Iron Sheik transitional champ and then it's Hogan, bang. But they do actually kind of play up that relationship to start with.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand how Hogan and Backlund would be buddies, you know, behind the scenes there. You know, would Backlund, with his strict training regime of doing kind of squats and stuff, I don't see Hogan as that type of athlete, really. But yeah, that those two against the Samoans. Did you watch ever track down that match, Parv?
It's on that footage that I was. I actually watched it live on. Well, I say live. I watched it on.
You got a time machine.
that particular edition of Championship Wrestling.
Yes.
So, yeah, and that's when he makes the announcement that he's turned his back on his previous ways. The weird thing about Hogan in 84 and 85 that people might not remember is that he was still tied in or committed to doing these New Japan tours for Inoki. So he basically wins the belt and then immediately goes on the New Japan tour. And who is the tag partner there?
It's the recently passed Iron Mike Sharp, the clean freak of pro wrestling. Someone that was, you know, a bit OCD, was always in the showers long after the other wrestlers. But yeah, they went on a tour, didn't they, in January 84. So this is, like you said, just after he beat Iron Sheik for the title.
Very unlikely partners, I would say.
Maybe he showed him the ropes. I don't know. Hogan had toured before in Japan, well before this anyway.
Because
he had the run with as the IWGP, kind of with the Grand Prix, which was the precursor to the championship. And that famous match with Inoki, didn't he, where he knocked him out?
Yep. Unlikely tag partner for Hogan, but of course he was still heel over there in Japan. Then he kind of has an ongoing friendship with Andre the Giant in Andre's ongoing issues with Big John Studd. And I mean, this Studd would kind of transition between facing Andre and facing Hogan. And that feud went on for a number of years. So would you see Andre as a big Hogan buddy around this time, Alan?
Well, I think it's classic Hulk Hogan here, because look at Hogan. Gets the belt, first thing you do, buddy up with the Giant. Buddy up with the Giant, then he won't worry about a title match. And that worked for a good 3 years, didn't it, Parv? So I think that was an astute someone to go straight to is Andre. So well done, Hogan, there.
Then he goes back to Japan for another one of these tours, and his tag partner on this particular run is the Masked Superstar. Another pretty unlikely partner for Hogan, I would suggest.
Yeah, and someone that, you know, you wouldn't see those two working tags in the US. They didn't really have a common allegiance, or if they're going after someone. But, you know, New Japan just put two guys in together that would work well with the other guys, and I don't think there was much more thought put into it than that.
The next kind of friend we've got here, and this would be, I would say, someone not only synonymous with Hogan, but synonymous with the WWF during this period, and indeed the whole kind of boom era. And that's old Mean Gene Okerlund. He was an ally in the feud against George Steele and Mr. Fuji. Do you remember this when Okerlund actually got involved and had an actual match against George Steele and Mr. Fuji?
Yes. I love this. I actually watched it. We touched on it on a previous show where I managed to get hold some of the tapes or watch some of the footage from this time period. Luckily, this would have been, you know, late 90s. So I saw this quite a few years ago, and it was great to see Gene Okerlund not as such let his hair down, because he didn't have any hair to let down. But it was a tongue-in-cheek kind of some of the stuff, wasn't it? I mean, the match itself was played. It was quite hammy. They trained together, didn't they? And it was, you know, it was the odd couple. It was the best way to put it, Parv.
I always remember Mean Gene in his wife fronts there. It feels like he's wearing wife fronts, because it's quite weird to see Gene in an actual match in a pair of tights. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, that was famously on one of those early tapes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was on, and one of the images I remember as well is Mean Gene getting a piggyback up some steps from Hogan as Hogan's sweating profusely, and the actual image looks a little bit sus. But yeah, that's an image that's unfortunately burnt into my brain.
Yeah, and Ventura was involved with this whole angle as well. He seems to kind of be in and around that Fuji Steel alliance, because he was angling for a kind of shot at Hogan during this period, but of course he got injured. So and he was kind of transitioning to be part of the broadcast team, so there's a bit of Mean Gene Ventura rivalry going on here as well, which would they'd touch on, because he'd always call him Scheme Gene years later, wouldn't he? So there'd always be a bit of that in their chemistry. Then of course, I mean, obviously Hogan couldn't tag with Okerlund around the horn, so instead they brought in Mad Dog Vachon to be the ally against George Steele. Now, do you remember much of this kind of heel George Steele in 84? Right, it's kind of, we tend to remember George Steele as the babyface against Savage, don't we? But do you remember this George Steele?
I don't really remember it. I can't ever say I've seen him work heel in this period anyway. So yeah, he was an ally, you know, Mad Dog against George Steele and Mr. Fuji. And I think, is that Hogan going back to his AWA roots there?
Yes, the old AWA connection. The Mad Dog would come in for shots, basically. His brother Paul was kind of on the roster week to week, and Mad Dog would make shots, I think, during this period. So into 85 now, and Hogan in the first of a number of these moments where he trains a guy up, you know, he spots talent, gets him in the gym, you know, gives him on the job training, and that was Hillbilly Jim. Hogan gave Jim the pair of boots that Hogan trained with for 6 months before winning the world title.
Well, this is a precursor to a Brutus Beefcake type character associated with Hogan, because he's taken someone under his wing. He's, you know, I'm surprised Hillbilly Jim wasn't one of those guys that turned up in WCW in 94, you know, with the rest of the band of Hogan followers, like the Nasty Boys, and maybe not the Nasty Boys, more like Honky Tonk Man, Kamala, all these kind of guys. So I was surprised Hillbilly Jim, you know, reappeared years later as I think he was the manager of the Godwins. But yeah, Hillbilly Jim at this time, kind of a fit that would go well with Hogan, showing Hogan as kind of the guy that's leading, not the youngster as such, but someone with less experience.
Yeah, just showing that he's prepared to give back, you know.
What a guy.
So then he kind of takes this training gimmick on a bit more and picks up Mr. T as a friend.
That's a good bit of you know, we'll talk it like we'll talk the managers with Heenan or the, you know, from the other episode. So yeah, it's a good bit of work here from Hogan picking up Mr. T.
Now here's a genuine question, Alan. Who do you think is leeching off who here? Do you think Hogan is leeching off Mr. T popularity, or Mr. T is leeching off Hogan popularity, or is it mutually beneficial?
I think Mr. T is bigger than Hogan still here. I mean, Mr. T, 86 Mr. T, when he's having the boxing match with Roddy Piper, isn't as big in US culture as he was in 85. 18 was still huge around this time. I'm a big 18 mark. I remember watching the reruns on ITV on a Saturday afternoon here in the UK. A few years later, I had a 18 colouring book. I remember the WWF episode where the Bulldogs were on it, the 18 as well, around this period. Yep. So I think it was definitely, it really helped WrestleMania as well, having Mr. T on. So I really think it was Hogan, you know, benefiting from T rather than the other way around.
While we're at it, who was your favourite? Was B.A. Baracus your favourite out of the four of them?
No, it's got to be Mad Murdoch, talking Mad Dog Vachon. I think Mad Murdoch was probably my favourite character on that, and Hannibal, both those two first. But yeah, good fan of the show. Is that a show that you used to watch as a child, Parv?
Oh, absolutely. I had the bedspread and all of it. I had Transformers and A-Team. Bed covers, you know.
I'm gutted there's not a Transformer tie-in with wrestling. I mean, we had in Jim Crockett, we had a kind of laser Tron sort of thing. The GoBots were mentioned in some New Breed promos, but never the Transformers. But getting back to the A-Team and Mr. T, yeah. he was a big star, so I think it really helped Hogan, and it helped promote the WrestleMania, you know, show that was coming up in March.
Yeah, but here we have Hogan doing the whole training deal again. I mean, he did a lot of training of other people, didn't he? Kind of showing Mr. T the wrestling ropes. I mean, obviously Mr. T was a tough guy, but he didn't have wrestling training. So.
No, perceived tough guy at the time. You know, this is in an era when, you know, you would perceive guys with muscles, huge guys, you know, that would say they're tough and act tough. You would presume that they are and they could handle themselves. But, you know, looking at, you know, the landscape now, the tough guys, you know, in MMA, look at guys that are perceived tough, like Kimbo Slice. Unfortunately passed away recently, but he was a character that was kind of touts as this real tough street, you know, street fighter and whatnot, and he didn't do as well in MMA, and I think Mr. T would have been exposed, and this kind of gimmick wouldn't work now, where there's a tough guy from a TV show.
I pity the fool who thinks that they could take on Mr. T in a sheet. Now, one of the things they did as part of this is that they appeared on a show called Hot Properties, hosted by Richard Belzer, and during a segment, Hogan put Belzer in a headlock, with Belzer falling face first onto the floor and cutting his head, and Belzer later sued Hogan, and the case was settled out of court. So there we go. But you can see them going around, you know. They also did Saturday Night Live, which is a big deal in the United States, Alan.
Yeah.
On NBC. And also Liberace was part of that broadcast with Roddy Piper. So.
Well, I think that is a pivotal kind of... That encapsulates the make or break, that date, which was the 30th of March, 1985. And I really, you can't underplay this, really, Parva, you know, to the listeners that, you know, up until, you know, the show itself, everyone was still worried. It was sink or swim with the WWF. They ploughed a lot of money into this. And, you know, and if it went down, you know, WWF may not have been around on a national scene. I can still imagine them around as, you know, a Northeast entity. But this was make or break for them nationally. And being on Saturday Night Live, which was a huge show on NBC, coming out of New York in, you know, this period, it was the biggest show, you know, in 80s on TV, or one of anyway. And, you know, having those two on, Mr. T, Hogan, Piper, and Liberace, you know, really pushed home how WrestleMania was the hot ticket, you know, show to watch at the time, and that paid dividends, you know, overall, and that's why potentially we're fans today, Parv.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't. You're right, Alan. Especially for us as UK fans. I mean, who knows what wrestling would have looked like in this country if Vince hadn't kind of invaded in the early 90s, eh? Anyway, let's move. Oh, a couple of last things on the A team. I sometimes like to think, you know, who would you be on the A team out of the four of them? I always like to think I would have been the face, you know. He was a ladies' man, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing is that, do you remember on at the end, like in the end credits of the A-Team, there was that guy on his typewriter.
And
he threw it. Yeah. I got a little, a couple of, like about a year ago, I got a little bit obsessed with that guy. I was like, I want to be that guy. You know, grow a beard, like have the sports jacket, you know, sit in a big office. I mean,
and throw bits of paper around.
I'm sure. Yeah, I thought that's a guy I want to. That's a guy I aspire to be like. So there we go. Anyway, let's move on because then, of course, Mr. T kind of appeared on Saturday Night's main event, and Oakland got involved in a match against Jesse Ventura. This was obviously a house show, but I thought this was an interesting result, Alan, that people might not know about. Hulk Hogan defeated Jesse Ventura via countout in 9 minutes after Gene Okerlund grabbed Ventura's leg to prevent him from getting back in the ring. Pre-match stipulation stated the title could change hands on a countout or DQ. So, did you know that Hogan and Ventura actually had matches, even though they didn't make tape?
Yeah, I knew that they had matches, but this match is interesting why they would have maybe used Gene Okerlund as well. Look, it's in Minneapolis, which is AWA country.
AWA country, Ventura an AWA star, of course. So
I think that was kind of the fit for why that was run, you know, in that market at the time.
Yeah. Okay, and then who's the next friend? Well, here he is, the turncoat himself, Paul Orndorff, in a feud against the Heenan family. Orndorff tags with Hogan, makes the save for him. For example, against Kempatera, when Big John Studd attacks.
There's Patera and Studd doing a beatdown on him, and then yeah, if Paul Orndorff comes out for the save, and it's also with Piper and Orton as well. Orndorff comes out, but Orndorff, I have no time for Orndorff in WWF. He's the biggest turncoat ever. He'd been in the Heenan family, I think we discussed twice, wasn't it, Parv? And was it, what was the reason? I think, did he not want anything to do with Heenan, or Heenan didn't want anything to do with him or something, while they split?
I don't know. It was just Orndorff, he just wakes up one day and wants to fire his manager. So I'm not, I'm with you, Alan. No time for the fair weather, Paula. who's the next big ally here? I can see it's Ricky Steamboat as an ally in the Don Morocco Mr. Fuji feud. So this is around the time of Fuji Vice, of course. And so what do you think it is? Do you think it's Hogan kind of benignly giving a rub to all of these hot new baby faces coming in?
Well, in a way, because it's Ricky Steamboat's 85, isn't he? So, you know, he's new to WWF around this time. Sticking with Hogan, you know, put him as a nice kind of baby face to align with. That works. Then he goes back to Andre, doesn't he?
Yes, against Studd and Bundy around this sort of time. And, of course, you can see that Hogan's got ongoing issues with the Heenan family, as does Andre. So that they're natural allies there. Then, of course, Terry Funk comes in, and they have a, you know, he has a feud with Terry Funk, and then that transitions to the Funks taking on JYD, and of course the Haiti Kid, the little midget. Have you seen any of that stuff? It's quite
There's a photo. I may send this to you for when the show goes out and drops, because it's a fantastic photo. I think it's JYD and Hogan holding the Haiti Kid. Yeah. And it's such a random photo. Yeah, I'll dig that one up and send that over to you, Parv.
I have seen that. There's quite a few different... I think there's even a match where Jimmy Hart is actually in the match as well, as a kind of like opposite of the Haiti Kid, you know. It's kind of interesting, that whole feud. But yeah, the Funks Terry Funk on his promo says he's going to basically murder the midget, basically. And JYD and Hogan are kind of rushing to his aid. So it's kind of interesting feud. But then, of course, he allies with George Steele. So tables have turned a couple of years later. And now Steele is one of his friends till the end against Randy Savage. So, yes. And then he allies with his old nemesis, Roddy Piper, Alan, against, guess who? Paul Orndorff and the Heenan family.
Oh, of course.
And Harley Race. Any memories of the Piper-Hogan friendship?
Kind of not anything that I really stands out to me. Was this kind of, were the buddies on screen a lot around this time? Because this would have been late 86, I think.
This is kind of like early babyface Piper, just before he goes to the movies. Around the time he would have been feuding with Adrian Adonis, I want to say, around this sort of time.
Maybe, yeah.
Okay, and then he basically keeps these same sorts of friends. Like, obviously, Andre's a mate. Steamboat is a mate on and off. Steele, when he's around. Obviously, Oakland on screen is an ally. But in 87, he also tags on occasion with Coco Ware. Obviously, over with his pile driver act in this, you know, in his music thing at this point. The Birdman. And Hacksaw Jim Duggan. And I always thought the Jim Duggan-Hogan friendship was natural with the USA connection.
Yeah, I think that was a natural line. I'm just trying to think now. When Savage was a face and had the title for that year run, did he have as many buddies as Hogan? Obviously, he had Hogan in the Mega Powers. But did Savage actually try and buddy with anyone else? Or is this kind of just like a Hogan trait? Because I don't think Bret Hart really buddied up to too many people either, did he? I mean, apart from his mate Virgil. Everyone's mates with Virgil, though.
I don't recall Savage buddying up with anyone apart from Hogan.
Yeah, so this is, I think this is a Hogan trait throughout his career, isn't it? Having, you know, in the WWF, especially, and in WCW, having his mates. Because as soon as he got to WCW, you know, he aligned himself with Sting straight away. You know, and Lex Luger and, you know, people like that who, you know, turned on him. You know, Luger turns on everybody. But yeah, I think buddies throughout his career.
Do you think this is a containment strategy of Hogan to make sure nobody else gets any bigger than him?
In some ways, I think, you know, putting faces on. So, I mean, I don't know with certain people, because he can't be that stupid to try and think, you know, him going with Beefcake, that's going to, you know, keep Beefcake down. I mean, I think that elevated Beefcake, you know, more than, you know, he would have had otherwise.
Well, let's wrap up on the buddies here. Because in 88, of course, there's the Bigelow friendship. Bigelow is the primary ally against DiBiase and Andre in that kind of February, March sort of time. A couple of tags made tape around then. In fact, one of the only matches where Ted comes out with the belt has got Bigelow as the partner there. See that as a good friendship?
Yeah, another up-and-comer. I would have loved Bigelow to teach Hogan how to do cartwheels. That would have been an interesting visual. We never got to see that. But yeah, I mean, Bigelow in 88, and Bigelow in general, he's got such a kind of varied career, because he worked everywhere, really. If you look at Bigelow's career, he was all over Jim Crockett, he was in ECW, he had, you know, a couple of stints in WWF as a face and as a heel, he was in New Japan, later again in WCW, where he was working more as a hardcore wrestler, in that triad with Canyon, I think, and DDP. So yeah, he'd done a lot, Bigelow. So this was earlier on in his run, and I think, you know, for Hogan to go with Bigelow is just normal Hogan, isn't it? Get the up and comer, go with him, you know, and, you know, get some rub for Bigelow.
And then, of course, the biggest friendship, or the friendship turned sour, Randy Savage, the Mega Powers. Now, this probably warrants us pausing a little bit. What's your assessment on Hulk Hogan, the friend Randy Savage, Alan?
Well, he just wanted to get in Elizabeth's pants, you know. I mean, I was with Savage, you know, throughout this. Hogan, you know, picking up Elizabeth. You know, if that's someone else's girlfriend, you know, you're not doing what Hogan's doing. He's getting a little bit too touchy-feely for my liking. I can see Savage's point, you know, piss off Hogan, that's my lady. Savage was the champion, he didn't need Hogan. I think Hogan being around Savage was more to benefit Hogan than it was Savage at the time, you know, so Hogan would still be hogging the spotlight. And I was with Randy Savage throughout this feud.
Always making sure he's there in the final frame, isn't he, Hogan? He's like, yeah. He's like one of those friends who just can't...
Always mugging the camera.
Yeah, never gets out of the way, and I'm glad that Jesse just called him out on all of that BS for the entire run. So
no, yeah, I think Jesse was someone I enjoyed because every time Hogan did these things, you know, I mean throughout Hogan's run he did some questionable things and he did cheat in matches as well. He used to like to do things like rake the eyes and rake the back, which were traditional heel maneuvers really, weren't they? So you know, we've seen times where Hogan, you know, was completely bang out of order, but we were still supposed to, you know, root for him, such as the Royal Rumble 92, where he gets pissed off that, you know, he gets thrown out legally by Sid and Ric Flair, and then he pulls Sid out at the end of it. And that's what I was with Sid in that one as well.
Absolutely. I'm with you. I mean, I'm a lifelong anti-Hogan fan, I guess. I hated him as a kid. Anyway, moving on to 1989 now, and a momentous friendship blossoms in 1989 as his friend to the end, Brutus Beefcake, starts tagging with him in the feud against Randy Savage and Zeus. Now, of all the Hogan buddies, do you think the most Hogan buddy is Brutus Beefcake?
Yeah, you know, on screen and off screen. I mean, he was called Dizzy Hogan early in his career as well. They played brothers. So there was a connection going back to the late 70s with Beefcake and Hogan as they, you know, came up through the ranks. And, you know, Beefcake, he was a Hogan yes man. And, you know, I think behind the scenes as well, they may have done things together. You know, I'm not going to, you know, allegedly, I'm not going to say really much more. But, yeah, Beefcake and Hogan, friends to the end, like you said.
And then over into 90, and there's a feud against Mr. Perfect and the Genius, where the big boss man is the big ally. Do you remember any of that sort of stuff? I mean, they have quite a long feud against Perfect and the Genius.
Hogan being with the boss man, I don't really think that's much. Boss man in 1990, he turned. Is Hogan wise to really, you know, still, you know, be mates with the boss man after boss man was feuding with him, you know, a year or two earlier?
Yeah, well, we've seen, like, he's had a history of tagging with old rivals, really. Piper, boss man, we've seen that. What about the next one here, Tugboat? Now, if I remember this correctly, wasn't Tugboat another of these kind of guys who he kind of took him up, he trained him up, took him from the streets type thing, like another hillbilly Jim?
Yeah, I love that. Took him from the streets, took him from the streets of Florida, right under the nose of Dusty Rhodes, into the WWF as Tugboat Taylor, I think he was originally. What a rubbish gimmick. What a tugboat. If you're going to be anything, you're going to be like a battleship, you know, or, you know, an aircraft carrier, name it something, but a tugboat.
Boop, boop.
Exactly, and he had that stupid little sailor hat on and the stripes.
Now,
my word.
Wasn't Tugboat originally meant to be like a Hogan super fan? Wasn't he just like a fan in the crowd type thing?
Yeah, I think that was the way they played it, because Earthquake was kind of someone that came out the crowd as well, if you remember when he debuted, but that was where he sat on Ultimate Warrior. I don't know if you remember that, when he came out of the stands as the Mountain Man.
That's right, and he was the Canadian Earthquake to begin with.
Yeah, and he had that Canadian, he had horrible brown kind of singlet or trunks, or like the suit that he had as later on, but that he had in blue, but it was brown, and a little Canadian flag, you know, in the centre of it.
That's right. Well, anyway, Tugboat, a big Hogan buddy. I think he turns on him in the end, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, I think for Tugboat.
Well, the natural disasters form. A little bit later. Then, he obviously tags with Duggan against Slaughter and Adnan and Colonel Mustafa, and then another ally here, another old rival, the Ultimate Warrior, in the match made in hell. What do you think of the Warrior-Hogan kind of relationship here? Natural friends or two alpha-alpha, do you think?
Very alpha-alpha. You know, the friendships, you know, are two lead faces. Sometimes work, sometimes don't. I mean, Lex Luger and Sting, day on and off, but they kind of those kind of played off each other better than Warrior and Hogan, because like you said, two alpha characters, you know, and Warrior was as clued up as Hogan. He knew that, you know, what Hogan was trying to do, and Hogan knew what Warrior was trying to do, and you know, they're both wanting to be number one.
Yeah, I think the problem there is that, I mean, the Luger Sting friendship works because Sting is the stupidest person in the history of the world. Whereas Ultimate Warrior, he was, you know, despite appearances, clued in, wasn't he? He was clued in. So Hogan wasn't going to get anything past him.
Well, you're the first person to ever said Ultimate Warrior is clued in about around this period.
Compared to Sting.
Oh, yeah, he didn't, you know, how many times did people turn against Sting, especially Lex Luger? You know, Sting always, you know, had him back.
And then, of course, he's an ally with Roddy Piper in the whole Flair, Undertaker, Sid kind of period. Piper seems to be the main ally around that time. And then, finally, and, you know, this is the kind of last thing Hogan would do before leaving for many years, it would be Brutus Beefcake against Money Inc., of course. He comes back, the friend till the end, to protect his old friend Brutus Beefcake against that dastardly Irwin R. Scheister.
They were the Mega Maniacs, weren't they? No.
Yeah, the Mega Maniacs, that's right.
Are you sure it was the Mega Maniacs? Because what was the... There's the Mega Powers.
Yeah.
What was the Warrior and Savage team called?
The Ultimate Maniacs, I want to say.
Maybe. I mean, someone's probably going to, you know, screaming, listening to this saying, you know...
I think it's the Mega Maniacs against Money Inc., I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. Yeah, so the Mega Maniacs. So this is Beefcake with his full-on mask gimmick. So Beefcake kind of got waffled by the Money Inc. briefcase, didn't he, on an episode of Raw?
Yes, one of the greatest moments in wrestling history. Now, just before we leave this topic, why do you think they did this constant buddying up for Hogan? It's kind of strange, isn't it? I can't think that other top babyfaces did this as much as Hogan did. Like, not just the tagging, but the kind of... The constant need to have a little buddy that he would help out, run out and make saves for, that would come out and make saves for him. You know, the training segments that, you know, he did it with Hillbilly Jim, Mr. T, Tugboat. What is all this about? Do you think it's just a facet of his character that he's a loyal friend, or?
Oh, I think it works, you know, as Hogan. Yeah, he's a loyal friend. He's a friend to the end. You know, he'll come and help you in the hour of need. He's not, you know, selfish. That's why he wants to be portrayed as. But, you know, his character traits say otherwise, you know, throughout this run. But that's what he wanted to perceive, I think, him and Vince, as a guy that, you know, took on up-and-comers, trained guys, and, you know, helped them out. But, yeah, I mean, Hogan, for you, as you said, you weren't a fan of him, were you, Parvin? Could you see through what he was doing around this time when you were a fan?
Oh, I mean, I just thought he was cynical as hell. And, you know, in 93, he was in Beefcake as a stepping stone to get a sneaky shot in against Yokozuna to take the belt there, for example. Or in that whole deal with Earthquake where he, you know, he celebrates like he's won the World Cup when it's all counts out win, you know. I just thought all the way through it, the whole Andre thing where he wouldn't really give him a shot. You know, we've discussed this before, haven't we? I just think that Andre had a really legitimate gripe against him in 87. You know, he didn't give him a shot. I think that Savage was basically correct in that whole feud. You know, he did stick his oar in during WrestleMania 4. He did put his hands places where he shouldn't have. Yeah, I mean, the only one that I can see here where I wouldn't say that Hogan ever did anything wrong is Hillbilly Jim, to be honest. Just seems like he gave him his start and, you know, then left him to tag with Uncle Elmer. So
yeah, but yeah, I mean, Hogan, I'm glad we went through that because it's quite interesting seeing all his buddies. And like you said, he is that one champion that had to be aligned, not always 100% on TV, but there was always, you know, comments on commentary that he had buddies as at the very least.
And the one last thing I'll say is that I think that Gene relationship, you know, because I think it may have even been Hogan who coined, like, me, like, he always put Gene over in his promos, didn't he? When he, you know, well, you know, Mean Gene and all that sort of stuff. I think it was absolutely pivotal that it was Oakland in the ring when he does the heel turn in WCW. I think that's an underplayed aspect of that. Like, that's so effective because they've been great mates since 1984. Do you know what I mean? Or even before that, if you go into the AWA.
No, I think that's a valid point. And, you know, the other more of a special relationship, you know, than say if Sean Mooney was interviewing Hogan or anyone else, they would always, they'd play off each other quite well, I thought. And it was, I think they helped each other in a way throughout that time. And I think, you know, they were a good pairing. And yeah, that's all I've got really to say about those two anyway. So should we wrap up the show anyway, Parv?
Yes. Shall we do that on magazine before, just before wrapping up? I think we have a very quick magazine segment.
The new World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, on sale this Tuesday at your local newsstand.
Yes, we do, don't we? And this is just touching on from what we discussed before. So, Battle Cat, he's featured in the WWF magazine in a personality profile, and I'm going to say this was November 1990, and he has a little interesting kind of comment, and we'll just touch on that. So I'll just read what's said here. Is identity concealed by a mask? Battle Cat is one of the WWF's newest entrants and seems destined to make a name for himself. He's already taking steps in the direction since his debut. He has out-wrestled virtually every athlete who has challenged him. So, you know, and he mentions that he's got airborne skills. He's got body-to-body wrestling ability. He's very effective. Is an effective offensive weapon. He can exchange arm bars, leg sweeps, and double underhook suplexes with the best of Matt's scholars. And 9 times out of 10, he usually emerges from these skirmishes unscathed. So, you know, they big him up there. But the Brooklyn Brawler isn't really that supportive of Battle Cat. And he goes on to say that the WWF street hoodlum feels the Battle Cat lacks the necessary toughness to sustain in the World Wrestling Federation mat wars. Who is this Battle Cat, wonders the cigar-chomping brawler. I've seen him in the ring, and he doesn't have the moves to make it in the WWF. He's bound to fail. I'm just the guy who can make this punk suffer. Believe me, I'll teach him a lesson in pain and agony. So, you know, that's a feud that may have, you know, looked to be set up. And, you know, if the Brawler's, you know, mentioning Battle Cat, you know, Battle Cat's not really going to be destined to huge things, really. But that's quite interesting that, you know, the Brawler has something to say. And I think Tito Santana's someone else that has a comment about Battle Cat in his personality profile. He says, pound for pound, Battle Cat is one of the greatest athletes that I've seen thus far in the WWF, comments Tito Santana. He combines wrestling ability with astonishing strength to win his matches. Take notice, people. I think Battle Cat will be a hit here in the WWF.
Well, that kind of buries Tito Santana, doesn't it? Looking back.
Yeah, he's not really got an eye for talent there. He's astonishing strength, Parv. I mean, I didn't really, you know, see much evidence of, you know, him as a power wrestler.
I would say agility was the key. And they spent quite a lot of time going on about the Cat's cradle as the ace in the hole for him, so there we go.
So yeah, that was his we said that before, that was his kind of occult, well, it was his roll-up, wasn't it, pin. So yeah, Battle Cat there, he was featured, so they did have some plans for him if they were going to feature him. And there is a picture of him doing a step over toe hold and reverse leg scissors. Is it what the kind of says about the picture, and it's him in his actual debut match, which we said before his debut match was against Bob Bradley, didn't we, Parv? But that has his actual debut match was against the guy in his picture, and I've forgotten his name at the moment.
Paul Diamond?
No, that's not Paul Diamond. The picture there with the guy with the green shamrock on his trunks, that's Brian Costello.
That was
a match. It didn't make it to air, but that was taped the week before the match with Bob Bradley aired. So, you know, that match is kind of shown there. So, yeah, there we go with Battle Cat. So that nicely ties, you know, Battle Cat. I don't think he's someone we're going to really come across again in our coverage here of Letters from Kayfabe.
Wow. Okay, well... how can people get hold of us, Alan?
You can get hold of me on Twitter at Alan_Cheapshot. And what about you, Parv?
Yeah, I'm at Jerry Von K. And if you want to ask us a question, please remember to use the hashtag #LettersFromKayfabe so we can find it when we're looking back over all the mailbag questions in a few weeks.
here at SummerSlam, Brutus the Barber Beefcake and the World Wrestling Federation champion, Hulk Hogan.
You know something, Mean Gene? Ever since me and the barber hooked up, we've been hanging and banging, brother. And we also been riding our Harley Davidsons through a lot of heavy traffic, dude. But on the way to the Meadowlands today, when we hit the George Washington Bridge, it was in a standstill. So me and the barber, we just looked at each other, brother, and we decided to head for the water, brother. We headed for the Henry Hudson River, and just like Moses parted the Red Sea, that's exactly what happened when the pythons started heading for the river. And once we crossed the river, Mean Gene, everybody on Interstate 95 pulled off to the side. All the Hulkamaniacs with the stares in their eyes, with their jaws hanging, with the dumbfounded looks, couldn't believe the largest arms in the world hanging on to a pair of ape hangers, ready to do battle. They couldn't believe the gleam in the barber's eyes. And we know why, don't we, Brutus?
You know me, Gene. These are titanium steel blades. They will cut through absolutely anything. You know, I love the blades, Gene. The blades are part of me. Now, Madness, listen up. Because I'm going to make them part of you.
I can't believe that, Hulk Hogan.
You better believe it, Mean Gene.
Yeah.
But the thing that all those Hulkamaniacs that were stopped on the side of the road couldn't believe was the package I had riding on the back of my fender, brother. With those long, sexy, curvaceous legs that wrapped around me. With the arms that hung onto my waist for dear life. With a set of headlights that were pointed straight ahead, brothers. And the smile across the secret weapon's face. Just like an acre of sunshine. Satisfaction guaranteed. We're gonna take it to him, brother. We're gonna wipe out the Macho Man. We're gonna destroy Zeus. And then we're gonna get Scary Sherry and put her in her place. What are you dudes gonna do when the barber, the blade, and Hulkamania run wild on you?
Get ready for the big main event here at SummerSlam.
Wow.